This is Audible.
Podium Publishing presents Mage Lord, Book 3 of the Spellmonger series, written by Terry Mancor, performed by John Lee. Chapter 1. The Domain of Sevendor. "What a shithole," my brother-in-law Sargal said, as he surveyed my new fief from horseback for the first time. "What an utterly destitute, deserted shithole. Begging your pardon, men," he added as an embarrassed afterthought. "After all, this was my shithole now, my reward, my happily ever after, and as much as I wanted to take issue with his statement, I couldn't argue. Sevendor was a mess when we got there, with a pall of neglect as potent as any spell hanging over the entire domain. You could tell something was wrong long before you came to the main village. I'm not the kind of spellmonger, or newly dubbed knight magi, or even a mage lord, who looks too closely at the teeth of a gifted horse. But when His Grace, Duke Rard of Castal, and about half of Alshar, granted me an estate, along with my knighthood and other honours, to reward me for stopping, or at least slowing down, a goblin invasion, I had assumed it would be a picturesque feudal domain, with jolly peasants, verdant fields, a stout castle and a treasury full of coin. I suppose I could have found that during my search of the available vacant estates, but in truth that was not among my requirements when I made my selection of lands. It's not that I chose my boon poorly. Quite the contrary. I spent almost a week researching my options in the dusty corridors of Wilderhall, under the gimlet eye of Lady Arnett, the mistress of lands and estates for the Duchy of Castal, sifting through the available lands. The Duke had specified the exact level of landed fee from which I could choose, rated by some mysterious system the ducal court alone understood, and Lady Arnett had presented me with dozens of qualifying holdings on the Duchy's books, each folio wrapped in leather and sealed with her official seal. After spending days researching each one, discarding some and keeping others, and then agonizing about my choice, I finally made what I thought was the best one for my purposes. A small domain in the northeastern Castali Riverlands, along the Bontal River, only 400 miles away as the gull flies, and 600 miles as the river barge sails, from Talry, the town of my birth. My new fief was situated in the northern foothills of the Uwari Range, near the frontier with the Duchy of Rhemir, as far away from the goblin hordes in the west as I could safely get, in other words, and still be close enough to the war front to be of some use. And it had other advantages. It had been one of the regions helpfully suggested by the tree folk, for one. They had given me some guidance about where I should settle, and as they had roamed these lands for centuries before my people, I trusted their counsel. I still wasn't certain why they had taken an interest, but I assumed they had a good reason. I had been far more interested in other factors at the time I selected it. Sevendor was quite the prize estate, on parchment. According to the meticulously kept tax records, biannual reports, and correspondence from the ducal caretaker, the domain of Sevendor was supposed to be a well-tended, prosperous little estate, snug in the charmingly rugged foothills, with a sturdy little castle, a secondary tower fortress, a border tower, 3 prosperous villages, and 5 hamlets within its limits. Sevendor had been developed for 300 years, and was one of the former cadet estates of the famous House of Lensley. House of Lensley is one of the wealthiest families of the eastern Castali Riverlords, though recently somewhat fallen in estate. Once they ruled the entire Bontal in fief to the Duke, but despite the honour and prestige still attached to the name, their power had peaked about 100 years ago. There's still plenty of Lensleys around, of course, despite the house's proclivity for killing each other off in spectacular dynastic duels. But while Lensley was a rich and prosperous noble house of honour and repute, the Count of Lensley is the traditional head of the Riverlords League, and there are still a couple of powerful local Lensley barons still lingering around the Bontal. Sevendor hadn't been under Lensley control for 2 generations, thanks to an inheritance dispute between rival branches. That was the reason the duchy had taken control of it in the first place. It had been confiscated by the coronet as a fine to one of the younger Lensley barons for killing someone he shouldn't have at the wrong time and in the wrong place. Lady Arnett patiently tried to explain the history of Seven Doors Lords to me while my patent of nobility was being drawn up, but in truth, I hadn't paid much attention. I was the first wizard in 4 centuries who held land in service to a noble lord, breaking the royal bans on magic. I was excited. I wasn't interested in the history. I wanted to hurry up and get to the tiny little sliver of property she carefully removed from her dusty old books, not listen to a long, droning recitation of the colourful history of the domain. Perhaps I should have. I might have been better prepared. Seven Door was never any great prize. While technically in the Riverlands, it was 70 miles south of the nearest navigable river of any consequence. It was a hill country fief that hugged the valleys of the small but respectable mountains to the south, hardly mountains at all, compared to the majestic Mindons or the grand and rugged Kulines. So it wasn't exactly prime agricultural property the Riverlands is justly famed for. It was one of those odd slivers of territory that doesn't quite fit neatly into a region, a marginal property unblessed by the bountiful croplands of the river valleys below. There was another parcel 240 miles northwest I could have chosen, the domain of Ormacar, and I had been sorely tempted. It was twice as large as Seven Door, though half as fertile, and had 2 castles and 6 villages. But I had my reasons for choosing Seven Door. The folio described the estate as a strip running east to west about 6.5 miles long and 3.5 miles wide at the widest point. It was a kind of double-blind vale, 2 valleys stretching to a common gap to the northeast, separated by a low ridge and a big mountain. I had studied the map included with the folio as required for proper tribute filing, until I felt I knew it by heart. The smaller eastern area, known as Brestal Vale, had the better croplands for grain, while the larger western vale, Seven Door Vale, boasted an itinerant stream through its midst and several 100 acres of timberlands. Neither lobe was particularly fertile compared to domains closer to the river, but the peasants farmed corn, barley, wheat, beans, rye, millet, oats, garneth, goats, turkeys, and the occasional cow or sheep or llama. Both Brestal and Seven Door had a central village and a fortification for defence, and there were attendant hamlets and yeoman estates in each vale. About all the apocrypha I could recall from Lady Arnett's briefing on the domain itself was that Seven Door once had a modest fame for horse breeding, and there was reported to be a substantial nut grove, pecans in particular, within the domain. The cadet branch of the Lensleys, who had ruled there, exported a significant, though not substantial, amount of produce before they'd lost it. But according to the lackluster historical record, in its prime, Seven Door produced over 300 bushels of corn for export, 70 bushels of nuts, and 200 turkeys, chicken, and assorted fowl. But yields weren't what they used to be. Seven Door's recorded prime was over a century ago. The geography was what had sold me on it, but not for the usual reasons. The stream wasn't very large, certainly not navigable by anything bigger than a canoe. It ran cautiously through the centre of the vale throughout most of the year and flooded spectacularly every spring, according to the dusty reports. The croplands wouldn't support more than a few thousand people without importing grain. It abutted several larger domains, mostly local nobles of distinguished lineage and honourable repute, which didn't impress me in the slightest. Militarily, there wasn't much there either. I knew that it had provided a modest 20 conscripts for the recent Faresian campaign, the last recorded levy. But in its prime, it had sent over 300 militia to the disastrous Battle of Gomel, one of the innumerable frontier disputes between Castile and Rhemir. 3 generations of the Lensley line of Seven Door had perished in that war, along with every man the Vales had sent. Title had passed to a distant relative, who had never visited the domain, and whose son lost it to the coronet because of his hasty temper and quick sword. The little domain never really recovered from that setback. Besides the sudden lack of Lensleys, The drain on the folk of Sevendor had been critical. Not one of the Castali at the Battle of Gomel survived, Lady Arnett told me, and that had left Sevendor sadly depopulated, with fewer and fewer peasants on the rolls every year, or at least up to 6 years ago, the last time any reports were received by her dusty office. I liked Sevendor partially because it was remote and out of the way, naturally protected by mountains, yet but a quick 2-day ride south from the river port of Sendaria on Bontol, should I feel like doing any trade or need to get back to more civilized parts in a hurry. That was important. The Bontol River was thick with river barges, and was the central highway of the riverlands on this side of Castal. Go downriver 100 miles south to the Venlands, and you could ride to any of 3 other rivers within a day. That put Sevendor about a week to a week and a half from most of the riverlands, if haste was needed. I liked Sevendor. On parchment. It wasn't a large land. It was easily manageable, yet I believed it had great potential for development. I was also counting on its modest size and productivity to keep it from seeming too alluring to my neighbours. Property rights in a feudal society usually get settled with lances, in which I was poor, and I didn't want to waste my entire surplus on keeping my neighbours at bay. For that, it was perfect. It was too far from civilization to be considered more than a ward land, and its complete lack of strategic value left it unhampered by growth. It was an utterly average country knight's estate. It had been governed from afar for generations, appended to various high lords' titles as an afterthought, traded in dowries and weir guilds, and administered by proxy once it came under the coronet's ownership. No sitting lord of Sevendor had set foot on the property for over 60 years, and no lord of Sevendor had been in residence there for a century and a quarter. It showed. The neglect was obvious, from the moment we crossed the unwarded, unguarded, overgrown frontier through the low pass, Sevendor's front door. The country was pretty enough. Indeed, it was gorgeous. A tall, protective ridge of mountains enclosing pleasantly forested hills, the tallest of which, a giant fist of a mount directly in front of the low pass, rising just under the height of the ridges, grew bald and rocky at its summit, and it was majestic to behold. But once the caravan crossed the point where the map included with my patent indicated we should be there, after gazing admiringly at the central mountain, I started to realize that things were amiss in Sevendor. I pulled Traveller's reins to stop him, while Sir Kay and my brother-in-law Sagal both rode up beside me. I stared at the derelict, burned-out pile of rocks that was supposed to be the watchtower to my fief, noted the weeds growing thick within, and I started to get anxious. "What a shithole!" my brother-in-law Sagal said, as he surveyed my new fief from horseback for the first time. "What an utterly destitute, deserted shithole. Begging your pardon, men," he added as an afterthought. "This is Sevendor's frontier," I said quietly. "That's supposed to be a 3-story stone tower known as Hyre's Tower," I said, consulting the map. "Hyre really needs to do some maintenance," quipped my brother-in-law, shaking his head sadly. "That tower was taken in battle," Sir Kay's experienced eye informed him, 4-5 years ago. "Sire Menelan, I mislike this." "You think you mislike this?" I asked, with a mirthless chuckle. "This is my reward for saving 2 duchies. I'm starting to wonder if it was worth the trouble." There was a distant scent of decaying vegetation that cut through the crisp winter air. I wondered if that was the smell of neglect. "Where to?" asked Kay. He glanced at the split in the road, and road is a generous term. It was a roughly worn path, overgrown with weeds and only occasionally flagged. But it split, the left road going south and the right fork heading west. "Sevendor Castle is south," I nodded, as the rest of the caravan began coming into the vale. "East is Brestal Tower, the other estate. We'll start at the main castle. It's further, but I'd rather reach there by this afternoon, if possible. I only hope it's in better repair than the outbuildings," I said, as I nudged Traveller to the right, past the ruined tower. "May the gods grant it so," Sir Kay said, automatically, and followed. He didn't sound encouraged. But then Sir Kay rarely sounded encouraged about anything. The next indication that something was wrong was the boundary stone that indicated where one domain ended and the seven door began. 200 yards past the ruined tower, the west road took a turn for the worse, with rampant weeds growing through the pavers indicating a lack of regular use. That's where we found the stone, overgrown by weeds but noting the official location of the frontier. "This seems to be out of place," I commented idly. "Remind me to move it back where it belongs later." "Mage Lord Minelan, traditionally such stones are used..." "I know what they're used for, Sir Kay, and I know what it probably means. But it's getting late, and I don't like the look of that sky. Feels like snow." He couldn't argue with that. He was used to Bovali winters, which start much earlier than in the Riverlands and rage much harder. But there was no mistaking the smell of snow in the air. It was a good 10 minutes on that rough road before we saw any sign of humanity. Peasants, of course, bundled up in homespun threadbare cloaks of undyed wool and ratty furs against the chill, dutifully trudging about their business, herding goats or moving dirt or chopping wood. There weren't very many of them, though, and they didn't look very jolly. They wore uniform grey homespun, hemp or linen, and crudely woven straw hats. A few had cloaks of wool, leather or fur. No one waved or bowed. They didn't look frightened of our party, or even curious. Growing up a commoner, I did more complaining about the nobility than cheering, but I also knew that a good lord can make a land and its people prosper, and a poor one doom it to misery. These people had misery by the bucketful. "I'm glad we packed rations," Sagal said, his eyes wide as we rode past a peasant woman hacking at the dry earth with a fire-hardened stick. She was as thin as a bare blade. "Don't stare," I chided. "It isn't polite." I nodded to the collection of huts on the north side of the road, enclosed with a low hedge and wooden fence, not even a proper stockade. The huts within were in two varieties, the more common round hut, half sunk into the earth, the walls of wattle and daub and a roof of thatch. There were a few proper longhouses of timber and stone, likely barns, or the homes of wealthier peasants, but none were in good repair. A single lonely-looking grain silo of stone stood in the centre of the hamlet. There were a few scrawny, wide-eyed children playing in front of the huts, but they scattered and hid as soon as we approached. "This is the Mage Lord's hamlet of Gurisham," Sir Kay informed me helpfully, "a bonded commune." I didn't need to be reminded. I'd studied the map for hours. But according to the reports, there should be 30 to 40 families here. If there were more than 7 or 8, then I'd forgotten how to count properly. We passed by the depressing little settlement without interacting with anyone. I wanted to get to the castle proper. The road had evolved into a simple track through the brush, only wide enough for a single horse or light wagon. The brush on the sides was browner than green, and the prevalent form of plant life seemed to be rocks. They grew everywhere. The few frozen, cultivated fields we passed were full of them. "This looks like," Sagal began, quietly and darkly, "an excellent opportunity to prove what magic can do for a mageland," I finished. He chuckled wryly. "That's one way to look at it." It wasn't quite as depressing as Terror Hall in the Penumbra, where the soulless pantomimed real life under the eyes of their Gavani masters and human proxies, but it was beginning to remind me of that grim domain. As we followed the road across the little dale towards the village, we began to pass a few humble cottages, the homes to individual farmers or labourers, only slightly better than the peasant huts, really. They were separated by discouraged-looking groves of pines, wraithwood and hawthorns, or untrimmed hedges. Each had a small garden, or a pen for a pig or sheep, or a chicken coop or dovecote of some sort. But the gardens were barren at this point of the season. The people we passed barely looked up from their fieldwork as they hacked at the near-frozen soil, and I saw only 2 or 3 draft animals in evidence. "They can't be farming all of this by hand," Sagal said, confused. "There are no oxen or horses or even mules. Even a hill farm needs a beast or two to..." He was right. I'd seen 1 donkey and 2 llamas, but that was about it, as far as beasts of burden went. no oxen, no horses. These people can't afford the silage, I noted in a quiet voice. Goats are about the best they can manage, and you can't plough a field with a team of goats. Look at how few fields they've planted. Even allowing for fallow lands, they aren't farming a tithe of what they could be. Look how steep the hillsides are. Not much possibility of a lot of hay. Maybe some vetch, but you need oats for horses. We passed a few more lonely crofts and cottages along the way. Smallholders even poorer than their neighbours in the hamlet, but I didn't really start to get depressed until we hit town. The tiny village outside of the castle was essentially a ring of ancient huts, about 15 or 20 families, and some smaller wooden shacks, sheds, and a couple of barns. There were 3 proper timber longhouses, but the rest were conical wattle and daub huts. I counted at least 4 that had been burned out and not rebuilt, and there were foundation pits for easily another dozen. There was no wall, no wooden stockade, not even a ditch to surround the village. This was the largest settlement in Sevendor. The tax records had indicated that Sevendor paid tribute for 700 hearths, although there hadn't been an actual tribute payment since the duchy took over the estate. Each hearth meant someone was paying for the privilege to bake their own bread, the primary form of direct taxation on the common people. Each hearth could mean a family of anywhere from 3 to 30, but on average it meant about 5 people, in my experience. There should be 3,500 people in the domain, therefore, at that tax rate. But there couldn't be, not based on what I was seeing. The village may have held 70 hearths at one point, as the records indicated, but there was just a fraction of those now. And it appeared that those were all peasants, too, not tradesmen. No smith, no carpenter, no woodwright, no bakery, no tap house, no inn, no barber, no cooper, and certainly no spellmonger. Just peasant farmers scratching the barest existence from the frozen fields we'd passed. Between them, they farmed about 320 acres, one-third of it mine. But less than half of that had looked under cultivation. Sevendor Village was a ghost of its former self. As we rode through Sevendor Village for the first time, I watched the furtive glances of the adults and the curious stares of the children, their eyes downcast and their faces grown gaunt with malnutrition. There was no central building, although one house seemed a little sturdier than the others. Rugged-looking goats avoided the rangy dogs that loped wolfishly between the huts. The well in the village square was ringed with cobbles and frozen mud. The smell. "This place is disgusting," Sagal noted under his breath. "Someone has some things to answer for," I agreed, my ire rising. "This place has had the life and vitality ripped out of it by someone." Sir Kay sneered in contempt as he nodded. "Malfeasance or simple incompetence, it's still neglect, Mage Lord. There is no excuse for this." "This place is awful," Sagal noted, shaking his head in amazement. I thought about telling him to shut up about our new home, but my ire would have been misplaced. "I think we should go speak to this knight," I agreed. The presiding steward of Sevendor, I'd learned at Wilderhall, was one Sir Erenthal, a landless knight who had a few powerful friends at court and who apparently took the job to enjoy the perquisites of lordship without any of the real responsibility. All he had to do was make sure no one walked off with the place and keep it running. It should not have been too difficult. Officially, he oversaw taxation, local justice, and was in charge of keeping the castle and lands in good repair. Everything a legitimate lord of the land would do. Since the bridge we crossed on the way into the village was damn close to rotting out under our horses' hooves, the stocks on the other side occupied by 2 half-frozen, emaciated rogues, and every piece of homespun we saw was threadbare, I could surmise that Sir Erenthal was better at the first 2 tasks than he was the last. I would have to have words with him. After the appalling state of the village, I wasn't surprised by the fortress. I was actually more surprised that things weren't worse than they were. Sevendor Castle was also a disappointment, but it wasn't a ruin. Not quite. I'm used to castles, having lived in a few over the years as a war mage, but what appeared out of the thick overgrowth was not the kind of military fortification I'd come to expect in my travels. Sevendorf Castle sat in the southwest corner of the vale, on a rocky plateau overlooking most of the valley. Behind it was a 1,000-foot-high bare rock cliff of imposing grey stone, the northern escarpment of what passed for a grand peak in the Uwaris. The castle had been quarried almost on the spot, so it was built from the same grey basalt. From a distance, it looked adequate at best. There was an outer and inner bailey, and a shell keep at the height, most remote from the valley, behind two gates and a moat. The keep was a single square, four-story, crenellated basalt shell on a modest earthen mound, with a rounded turret attached at each corner. One of the front turrets was visibly crumbling. There was a smaller square tower, also four stories but half the size of the keep, added on in the shadows to the east, with a walled courtyard joining it to the main keep. The newest construction, only a century old, was a round five-story tower that peaked over the rear of the castle. It was what had once been known as the Lord's Refuge, the last-ditch defence a noble family could take shelter within if the main keep fell. It was attached to the main hall by both a thick stone portico and, on the third story, a railed wooden bridge that could be burned or destroyed to isolate the tower. The conical wooden roof, I could see without mage sight, was decrepit and falling in. A smaller square, three-story tower guarded the gate of the inner bailey, and another overlooked the village itself, although both appeared deserted. Surrounded by a crumbling stone wall and a muddy ditch, Sevendorf Castle had all the charm of the ugliest girl at the ball. In my professional opinion as a war mage, I could have taken the damn thing out all by myself, with one wand tied behind my back. It was old, of course. Maybe it had been cozy for that first lord and his kin. But it was built with petty squabbles and like-minded neighbours in mind, not pitched battle or prolonged siege. Certainly not proof against an army of goblins. Sevendorf Castle could keep marauders at bay and discourage the neighbours from coming over uninvited, but I've seen privies with better security and better designed. I won't even discuss the smells. We crossed the ancient drawbridge over the ditch at the gatehouse, and for a moment I thought we'd have a problem. One of the massive iron chains was broken, making the thing impossible to lift. Not only was that a serious breach of security, it also meant that the bridge wobbled when Traveller came across, and by the time the enclosed wain, with my wife, started through, I saw it tilt dangerously to one side. I patted Traveller reassuringly, but I was anything but assured. I could feel the team start to panic as the driver lost control. The coach slid 6 inches towards the side. Instantly, I sent out a tendril of force to magically shore up the bridge. The drover looked around wildly, then spotted me waving my hand meaningfully in the air, and understood. He nodded his gratitude. He calmed his team and coaxed them the rest of the way across the bridge, the carriage rolling safely behind.
"Show off," came the irritated voice of my wife from within. "I wouldn't mind you taking a bath in that reeking trench," I responded, "but that's my son you're carrying in there." "Who said he was yours?" she shot back quickly.
I smiled while the coachman turned pale. Usually the aristocracy doesn't joke about such things in front of servants, but seeing as how I had only been ennobled for a month, well, he'd just have to understand that we still retained our peasantish sense of humour. The truth was, I was absolutely sure that the child in Alia's womb was mine. Magic is good for that sort of thing. Something would have to be done about the bridge, though, I realised. I told off two of my men to find a way to brace it up before I proceeded any further. I don't like to be anywhere I can't leave from when I want to, and we had 20 more wagons to pass over that bridge tonight alone. The guards at the gate had the good sense to come to attention, or their best guess of the position, bringing their rusty pikes across until my herald, who was also my brother-in-law, rode forward.
"Make way," Sagal insisted, a little louder than necessary. That's always good in a herald. "Make way for the Lord of Sevendor."
What?
Asked the older of the two, confused.
Both were equally filthy and unshaven, but this one had a few years on his comrade, by the length of his beard. Both wore rusty steel pot helms and leather jacks, with rusty steel rings riveted to them. The older one was barefoot.
"Ain't no lord of Sevendor here, my lord," he replied apologetically. "Sir Aaron Tall rules here." "No, actually, the Duke ruled here," I corrected. "Sir Aaron Tall was hired as caretaker for the estate. Please summon him. I am now Lord of Sevendor by ducal decree," I said, nodding to Sir Kay. My new castellan nodded and pulled out a long vellum scroll from a waxed leather tube in his saddlebag. He opened it and showed it to the guards.
"Authentic patent of nobility, gentlemen," he explained, "signed and sealed by His Grace Duke Rad himself, assigning ownership of Sevendor to Sir Minolan the Spellmonger, Knight Mage of the Realm, and the heirs of his body in perpetuity for good and meritorious services rendered unto the coronet, all perfectly legal on my honour as a knight." Sir Kay seemed to relish the sound of the big legal words he had only just learned. They sounded a little odd, due to his thick mountain accent, but he said them with enough precision to be effective. The older guard examined the documents, then shrugged and grunted.
"Hells, I can't read. But you look lordly enough."
He added a hesitant bow as an afterthought.
What are your orders, my lord?"
"First, I'd like to meet the steward," I said coolly, "and have him give account of my estate. Then I'd like for rooms to be made available for my wife, who is great with child, and my men, who have been marching for 2 days. Dinner should follow at a leisurely pace. But first I want that God's damned knight out here," I insisted, and before too many more heartbeats pass. The tone of my voice was unmistakable, and the older man, after the smallest moment's thought, nodded to the younger, who scampered off through the gate and ran as fast as he could up the rise to the castle. Halfway there, he abandoned the pike so he could run faster.